Brothers and sisters, if you don't change your ways, you are on the road to Jam Nation.
As the snow flies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries, 'cause if there's one thing she don't need, is another hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto.
Welcome back, everybody, to Road to Jam Nation. In this episode, I'm going to continue my discussion of the music of 1969, leading into my next two episodes, in which I will reveal my top 20 favorite albums of the year. But before that, I'm going to continue from last episode in reviewing some of the interesting music trends of the year. During the late 1960s, there had been a trend of rock stars going to Nashville, Tennessee to use some of the studio guns that were there in order to bring some legitimacy to the evolving country rock trend. However, while Nashville was pulling in a lot of rock stars, as I said, Memphis, Tennessee was the preferred destination for artists that were looking to infuse their music with the deep Southern soul sound. Elvis Presley had begun a career comeback in December of 1968 when he appeared on a highly regarded TV special that had him returning to his rock and roll roots, as well as doing a couple of Christmas songs. Elvis followed up that good publicity with his first major studio album sessions in 8 years, after a long string of shoddy soundtrack albums and a few gospel albums. Elvis abandoned the RCA studio, and he returned to Memphis, where he had made his first records. The album Elvis in Memphis delivered Elvis Presley in a dramatic Southern soul style that suited his strong vocal work, and contained much better songwriting than his movie soundtracks tended to specialize in. Elvis in Memphis was a critical and commercial success, and the album wound up containing a number 3 hit with his song In the Ghetto. Colonel Tom quickly arranged for Elvis to return to live concert performance, booking a residency at the International Hotel in Las Vegas. These Vegas concerts began with Elvis revisiting his roots with 50s rock and roll, and then moving into his more recent work. During this Vegas residency, Elvis also released another new Memphis-born single, Suspicious Minds.
Why can't you see what you're doing to me? When you don't believe a word I say,
in the Vegas concerts, Suspicious Minds would wind up stretching out into epic concert climaxes that often lasted over 7 minutes long. The Suspicious Minds single wound up going to number 1 on the pop charts in 1969. Recordings were made of a pair of these Elvis Vegas shows, and they were released as part of Elvis's first career double album, which was called From Memphis to Vegas, From Vegas to Memphis. The first disc of this album contained a recording of Elvis in person at the International Hotel, while the second disc of this double album contained Elvis recording back in Memphis, with that second disc being more studio recordings rather than live recordings. By the end of 1969, Elvis Presley was firmly back to superstar status. He continued into the early 1970s, performing to packed stadium-sized audiences around America. I personally like the music on the From Elvis in Memphis album. The production and arrangements are well done, and it features an outstanding rhythm section that just can't be beat. Elvis's performances are technically outstanding, but as was his style, they also tend to be a little bit cheesy, just a tad overly earnest and over the top, but that was who Elvis was at that point. The live album is pretty fun too, revealing a stage presence at these comeback shows in which Elvis sounds both nervous and excited to be back on stage in front of a live audience. He's a bit goofy and hyper in his interplay with the audiences here. That energy, though, helps to propel the performances and help to make the epic Suspicious Minds performance among the best work of Elvis's career, in my opinion. The studio disc from that double album, featuring more sessions recorded in Memphis, is a bit disappointing to me. That disc has much less compelling song selections than the sessions that were released earlier in the year. If the live album had stood alone rather than as part of a double album with that lesser studio disc, it may very well have made my top 20 list. Or if that live disc had been teamed with that superior Elvis and Memphis album disc to make the double album, that would have absolutely guaranteed that that album would have made my final list. But as the albums were actually released, Elvis didn't actually make the cut for my 1969 album list with either of these two albums.
Train I ride, 16, hold your blow.
Dusty Springfield also headed to Memphis in an attempt to revitalize her career. Springfield had been a successful pop singer in the blue-eyed soul variety in the early 1960s. But with the cultural changes of the late 1960s, Dusty had become a bit unfashionable. Dusty signed to Atlantic Records, home of her idol Aretha Franklin, and she headed to Memphis to attempt to connect with the authentic soul music that had come out of that city. The recording sessions were difficult, with Dusty feeling insecure about her ability to live up to the musical legends that she was attempting to emulate in her musical approach. While the resulting album would still be titled Dusty in Memphis, in truth, the majority of the vocals for this album wound up being re-recorded in New York City due to Dusty's dissatisfaction with her performances in the Memphis sessions. As it turns out, the Dusty in Memphis album only sold moderately better in the United States than her previous three albums had, and the album fared worse in her UK homeland. However, these sessions did produce a top 10 hit for Dusty, which became, perhaps, the defining hit of Dusty Springfield's career, that song being Son of a Preacher Man.
When they gather round and started talking, Passin' Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.
Son of a Preacher Man was a song that had originally been presented to Aretha Franklin, and Aretha Franklin turned down the offer because she felt like the song was stereotyping her due to her being the daughter of an actual preacher. So the song wound up going to Dusty, who made a magnificent performance of it. And after hearing that single, Aretha Franklin herself relented and recorded her own version of the song. And it's a mark of just how good Dusty's performance was on this song that Aretha's version didn't wind up stealing the spotlight from Dusty Springfield's. This is one of the rare cases where the Aretha Franklin version of a song did not surpass the original recorded version. In this case, the version by Dusty. Both Son of a Preacher Man, the song, and the Dusty in Memphis album got generally good critical reviews when they were released, and the stature of both of them has simply grown over the years since then, often being mentioned on the longer lists of the greatest singles and the greatest albums of all time. I think that level of praise is a little bit overblown for the album itself, but the song Son of a Preacher Man truly is outstanding. The rest of the Dusty in Memphis album just can't maintain that same level of accomplishment. So the album didn't wind up making my top 20 list, but I'm pretty sure Son of a Preacher Man would make a top 20 list of my favorite songs of the year. One of the founders of real soul music, James Brown, spent a large part of 1969 obsessed with the popcorn, a new dance craze he was trying to champion. But James Brown, musically, was also continuing to explore his unique funk style. Of James Brown's 9 new singles that came out in 1969, 5 of those singles were related to the popcorn.
Popcorn!
Musically, those songs are great funky fun, but there's no doubt that the continued emphasis on this dance craze paid quickly diminishing returns as far as quality of music goes. And these popcorn songs have not aged as well as most of James Brown's other music from the late 60s and early 70s has. On album for 1969, James Brown started off the year with an album that collected 4 of his singles from 1968, including the historic Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud as the lead-off track to that album. And that track supplied the album's title as well.
You know all the work I did was for the other man. Now we the man that can do things for ourselves. We're tired of beating our head against the wall and working for someone else.
This album also contains Licking Stick. And Licking Stick is not as dirty of a song as one might think, since it's actually referring to licking as a style of corporal punishment rather than the sexy time version that might be related to that term. This album also contained I Guess I'll Have to Cry, Cry, Cry. This song, released as a single, wound up being the final single from James Brown that included credits for the famous Flames. And the song also would wind up being the template on which reggae group The Wailers would create their song, My Cup.
What to do? No, I don't know. No, I don't know. Guess I gotta cry, cry, cry. Don't let me cry, cry, cry. I feel a little bit better if I cry. I gotta cry, cry, cry.
Also on the Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud album was the song Goodbye My Love, a classic soul ballad by James Brown.
Goodbye my love, that's one more thing, you know. To have somebody to worry when you worry. To feel the need of a real person when your friends drop you behind. To kill your anger just by being nice and kind. I could say if you leave, it wouldn't bother me.
Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud is a solid James Brown album, though the mix of material on it feels a bit thrown together, as was usual for most 1960s James Brown studio albums. I often find fault with many of the James Brown albums of this era. He was really focused on singles rather than on the sequencing and internal integrity of a studio album cycle. And so for me, while all of his albums of the 1960s contain a lot of great material, most of them just don't hold together as solid end-to-end albums. James Brown's second album for 1969 is the absolutely fascinating album, Gettin' Down to It. On Gettin' Down to It, James Brown wanted to take a shot at an album of more traditional jazz-style ballads. James Brown was a big fan of Frank Sinatra, and he wanted to pay tribute to Sinatra's musical style. On Gettin' Down to It, James Brown covers some songs that Sinatra was well known for singing, such as That's Life and Strangers in the Night.
Wandering in the night, what were the chances we'd be sharing love before the night was through? Something in your eyes was so inviting, something in your smile was so exciting, something in my heart told me I must have you.
And on this album, James Brown also remakes his own classic funk song, Cold Sweat, delivering it in a more jazz-oriented arrangement.
Hey! When you kiss me, and you miss me now, oh my head, make me understand.
The focus for this album makes for a great album cycle of songs, and the performances on the album are completely unique. While musically, this album does indeed use a small band jazz trio approach, James Brown's vocal performances can't help but bring a much more soulful and swinging presence to the songs on the album to transform all of them well away from the style of a singer like Frank Sinatra. I love the Gettin' Down to It album, but it did wind up getting cut from my final top 20. Since it is an album of mostly cover songs, and there are simply too many good albums full of original songs to choose from in 1969 for this excellent album to have been able to elbow its way onto those charts. But I would recommend it to anybody that wants to hear James Brown in a little bit different style than they're used to. James Brown's third album in 1969 is The Popcorn, and of course that album contained that song as its lead-off track. The Popcorn is a dance-oriented album, and only one song on the album is explicitly about the popcorn. But the other songs on the album are very similar stylistically to that song. The album is certainly funky, but it's not one of James Brown's more interesting efforts. James Brown's fourth album for the year was It's a Mother. It's a Mother includes five more tracks related to the popcorn dance. It's the first James Brown album that I've ever listened to in which I had a hard time sitting through it without fast-forwarding. I'm very glad that James Brown moved on from this popcorn phase in 1970. By this time, there was a growing industry of acts that were pursuing and expanding on the funk genre that Brown and his band had created. The Isley Brothers had left Motown, and the Isley Brothers released two studio albums and a live album in 1969. And on these series of albums, the Isley Brothers transformed themselves into a funk outfit. The band scored a R&B number one with their new single, It's Your Thing.
It's your thing, do what you wanna do.
Neither of the Isley Brothers studio albums have enough great songs on them for me to have given them any real consideration for a spot in my top 20. But there certainly are some outstanding funky cuts on each of those albums. Also in 1969, Kool & the Gang released their debut album, but that band hadn't really hit their creative stride yet. So that debut album wasn't really an option for my top 20. It's simply the sound of a band trying to find its sound. So as I just mentioned during that last segment, the Isley Brothers had left Motown. A large part of the Isley Brothers' dissatisfaction with Motown was a feeling that the band were sort of afterthoughts to the label's big stars. And the Isley Brothers likely had a point there, as Motown and its subsidiary label Tamla had a number of true superstars still recording hits for them at this time. Stevie Wonder was now 19 years old. And at 19, he was releasing already his 10th studio album of his career, that album being My Sharia Moore. Stevie Wonder was becoming more confident at choosing his own musical path, and he was beginning to show signs of the maturing of his own songwriting abilities. Wonder was a co-writer on the hit title cut of this album, and that song, My Sharia Moore, showed signs of the sophisticated and lush original pop songcraft that Stevie Wonder would wow the world with in the early 1970s. But the album is still a bit haphazard outside of that title cut. To me, there's only one other truly great song on this album, that song being Yester Me, Yester You, Yesterday. Meanwhile, Marvin Gaye was soaring to new heights with his 1969 album, MPG. Marvin Gaye scored 28 top 40 hits during the 1960s. But with the album MPG, Marvin Gaye would achieve his first studio album to be ranked in the top 40. And the album set the stage for his career peak in the 1970s. MPG is centered on the million-selling hit song, Too Busy Thinking About My Baby. And I ain't got time to sit down and wonder what makes a birdie fly. And I don't have the time to think about what makes a flower grow. And I've never given a second thought to where the river flows. Oh yeah, and I ain't got. And it also contains his hit cover of the Isley Brothers song, That's the Way Love Is. But, like many Motown albums of the era, I fault this album for its reliance on a bunch of rather thrown-together cover songs to fill out the rest of the album, beyond the hit singles. Marvin Gaye also made a 1969 duet album with Tammy Terrell. This was the third time that the two of them had collaborated on a studio album. However, it would also wind up being the last, as Tammy Terrell would tragically die in 1970 from a brain tumor. it's since been revealed that Valerie Simpson may have recorded much of the actual vocals on this final Gay Terrell album, due to Tammy Terrell's failing health at the time. Overall, to me, this duet album is a stronger overall song cycle than the MPG album has, but it's still not among Marvin Gaye's best work. Smokey Robinson and the Miracles released two studio albums in 1969, as well as a new live album. Unlike Stevie Wonder or Marvin Gaye at the time, Smokey Robinson provided the majority of his own songwriting for his albums. But despite that, and despite that Smokey Robinson is well-renowned as an outstanding, successful pop songwriter, I can't say that either of his studio albums in 1969 has any particularly great work on them. Rare Earth was not the first all-white band to be signed to the Motown label, but the band would become the first actually successful white rock band to be on the Motown label. Motown even wound up making a new subsidiary label for Rare Earth, which they named after the band. Rare Earth's 1969 album, Get Ready, would become their best-selling album on the strength of the number 4 Get Ready title cut. This was a remake of a song that was written by Smokey Robinson, and the song had originally been recorded by The Temptations. The Get Ready album is a solid blues rock album, matching up well with a lot of the other fairly formulaic such releases that were going on in the industry in the late 1960s. Meanwhile, The Supremes and The Temptations both released two new studio albums each, and the two groups combined for a new collaborative album for the second time in their careers. For some reason, Motown never bothered to provide these groups with any quality new songs for these big collaborative releases. And even on their own studio albums in 1969, there were generally just a couple of new songs mixed in with a lot of often poorly chosen cover tunes. The 1969 albums from The Supremes would be the final ones to feature Diana Ross. The key track from this year from these albums is the song Someday We'll Be Together. This was an outstanding pop hit that would serve as the final number one song of The Supremes' career. Despite all of these superstar releases that I've mentioned here, the actual key release from Motown for 1969 would come via the debut of a new boy band. Motown marketing falsely claimed that Diana Ross had discovered this new band, and they would use Diana Ross to introduce the band on their first ever TV performances. And the debut album from this band was preceded by the title Diana Ross Presents. The band was the Jackson 5, and this debut album was Diana Ross Presents the Jackson 5. Though this debut album would produce only one hit song, which made it very similar to most Motown albums of this era, where there are way too many quickly chosen and quickly recorded throw-off cover tunes to fill out the album after the band had recorded what the label was convinced was one or two hits. The hit from this debut album was I Want You Back, and that song signaled the birth of a major new star with the infectious and confident performance of the group's young lead singer, Michael Jackson. Jackson was only 10 years old when I Want You Back was recorded, and he was not quite yet 11 when the song was released and he began promoting it with TV appearances. I Want You Back rightfully went to number one. It's an absolute classic, infectious piece of earworm pop that just cannot be resisted. Let's listen to it now. Enjoy! Detroit wasn't just home to the pop R&B hitmakers of Motown. The grittiness of Detroit came through in a new breed of hard-edged rock music that ran through the city. Bob Seger built his career on a working-class journeyman style of rock music. Unlike the other two bands that I'll be mentioning here in this segment, Bob Seger was always laser-focused on producing music that would get played on commercial radio stations. However, Seger never went in for flash over substance, and he refused to trend hop to suit the popular style of sounds of each day. Bob Seger had the vision for the straightforward rock music that he wanted to make, and he stuck with that formula. Seger built a huge loyal following in his Detroit hometown, but he struggled for years to draw large audiences elsewhere. However, eventually, through sheer persistence, Seger eventually built his audience outward from the Great Lakes region to an eventual national following. After spending the 1960s in a series of failed bands, Bob Seger finally released the first two albums by the Bob Seger System in 1969. The first of these two albums featured his first national hit song, with its title song, Ramblin' Gamblin' Man. With the energetic drive and great organ riffs of this song, I'm not sure Seger ever managed to top that song during his long career of hitmaking. Certainly nothing else on his debut album comes close to the excellence of that song. So that album as a whole is not a contender for my top 20 as much as I admire Ramblin' Gamblin' Man. The Bob Seger System's second album actually didn't even feature Seger as the frontman for the band. For the second album, Seger's record label brought in Tom Neame to be the new featured singer for his band. And Neame also supplied half of the songwriting on that album. Due to this label interference, Bob Seger has never allowed this second album to ever be reissued. And that actually is for very good reason, beyond Bob Seger's ego. The new singer in the band simply didn't work. That second Bob Seger album is really not very good at all. Meanwhile, the band MC5 had formed a reputation as a ferociously visceral live band in Detroit. And the band was also extremely political. MC5 played at Vietnam War protests in the streets, and they played for crowds outside the 1968 Democratic National Convention. MC5 were infamous for brandishing rifles as they took the stage for their performances, although those rifles were actually unloaded. And the band would sometimes stage mock assassinations of their lead singer as part of the climax of their shows. the band seemed to realize that there was no way that a traditional studio album would ever be able to satisfactorily introduce the band's sound and vision to a national audience. So for their 1969 debut album, the band was able to convince their label to release a live album recorded during their Halloween run of shows at the Detroit Grand Ballroom. This album was Kick Out the Jams, and the album was led off by the track of the same name, which included the infamous Motherfuckers exclamation at the start of the song. This, of course, wound up causing problems with retailers and angered the band's label. I personally gave the Kick Out the Jams album some serious consideration for my top 20 list. But ultimately, while this album has a great proto-punk primal energy to it, there's really only about half of its songs that are really any good, in my opinion. So I ultimately wound up cutting it for too much weak material. Also from the Detroit scene was The Stooges, although The Stooges actually originated in Ann Arbor, Michigan, rather than in Detroit. But the band made a name for itself, playing a lot of the same Detroit music venues as the MC5 did. The Stooges are now known as one of the foundational blocks on which punk rock was built. But the band started out much more as an experimental noise rock band than it did the more primitive sounding proto-punk that they would eventually move towards over the course of their career. From their start, the Stooges presented a wild and unpredictable stage presence, and they showed a willingness to antagonize their audiences. The Stooges released their debut album in 1969. This album still shows a lot of the experimental leanings of the band members, and their dedication to a primitive sort of psychedelic improvisation, especially on the 10-minute long song, We Will Fall.
On my back.
This debut album from the Stooges failed commercially, and at least initially, the album was also panned by most of the major music critics of the time. But the album connected with a generation of underground musicians. These days, the Stooges' debut album is an interesting timepiece, and when I watch video of Iggy Pop's performances of the air, they're all very fascinating. But much like the MC5 album, I think about half of the songs on this album sound like half-formed crap to fill out the running time expectation of a full studio album, even as short as that was in the vinyl days. I've never been enough of a fan of this debut Stooges album to give it any real shot at my own personal top 20 list. It does, however, help to again reinforce my initial notes from last episode, in which I declared 1969 to be a very weird year for music. Nobody had ever really heard anything like the Stooges when they released this debut album. And as I mentioned, while it did not perform well commercially, over time, that album and the other albums released by Iggy and the Stooges have become extremely influential on generations of loud, aggressive music. Let's listen to a little bit of the Stooges now. Enjoy!
Now we're gonna be face to face and I'll lay right down in my favorite place. And now I wanna be your dog. And now I wanna be your dog. And now I wanna be your
Another group that is sometimes celebrated as an influence on the punk rock movement was the Kinks, but that reputation is largely based on the Kinks' early garage rock style hits like You Really Got Me. During the later 1960s, the Kinks had forged a musical path in which they explored a uniquely English style of rock music that explored the modern and historical social fabric of English society. The Kinks' music fused rock and roll, psychedelic pop, and the traditions of English dancehall music. The Kinks released a new album in 1969 titled Arthur, or The Decline and Fall of the British Empire. This album had been intended to provide the soundtrack for an experimental English TV drama. Thematically, this album is loosely based on the family life of the Davies family during the post-World War II era. The TV show part of this project fell apart and never made it onto air, but the album produced for it was very good. The Arthur album was full of excellent music with a totally original vision, and it is ambitious music from the late 1960s that has not wound up being overplayed like so much of the other great music of that era has been. The Kinks were at a low ebb of popularity at this point in their career. Their new music did not fit in with the fashionable trends of the day, but that is part of the long-term strength of this music. This album these days sounds relatively timeless, aging like fine literature. The album wound up being a very serious contender for my top 40 list, and it would have made my top 25 list, I think, if I extended the list that far. I wound up just simply running out of room for it in what was a very strong musical year. I'll play the one song from this album that is a fairly well-known minor hit. This song hit number 33 in the UK and number 62 in the USA. The song is called Victoria. Enjoy! The Kinks were not the only band helping to infuse more homegrown English identity into 1960s popular music. The early part of the 1960s had been dominated by bands powered by the sounds of imported American blues and rock and roll, and even the strong influence of American folk music via the influence of performers like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. However, a strong foundational current within American folk music is based within the much older traditions of English and Celtic folk music. The experimentalism of the music scene of 1969 led to some extremely interesting English folk-based music. One of the leading bands of this movement was Fairpoint Convention. Fairpoint Convention's debut had come out in 1968 and featured Judy Dibble as the lead singer. After that debut, Dibble was replaced by Sandy Denny, and Denny would be the lead singer for three increasingly influential new albums by Fairpoint Convention, which were all released in 1969. Though the third of these albums, Legion Leaf, wasn't released in the United States until 1970. Therefore, that album is not eligible for my 1969 Top 20 list, because I base those lists on United States release dates whenever I can possibly do so. However, it should be noted that Legion Leaf is probably the most celebrated album by the band and is probably my personal favorite of all of the band's albums. These three Fairpoint Convention albums were important in setting off a folk rock movement in England. Sandy Denny would leave the group after 1969, and I personally don't think Fairpoint Convention was ever quite as satisfying without her in the band as it was during her short time within the band. And at the same time, I don't think Sandy Denny's solo career is anywhere as interesting as the music she wound up making in 1969 with this band. Of the two albums that were released in the United States in 1969, in my opinion, the better of the two albums was the second one, Unhalfbricking. Unhalfbricking has a rollicking and improvisational spirit to the musical arrangements, which take magnificent flight on the 11-minute-long version of the English traditional sea shanty, A Sailor's Life.
Your sailor boy, well, she wrung her hand and she tore her hair. She was like a young girl in great despair.
The musical vision and band interplay on this song has some similarities to the type of reinterpretations that Jerry Garcia would bring to such traditional folk songs in his work, both as a solo artist and in the electrified folk rock versions that he would play with the Grateful Dead. Unhalfbricking got serious consideration for a spot in my top 20. If more of the songs were stretched out in the same way as A Sailor's Life was, then this album would certainly have been a slam dunk for my top 20, given my musical preferences for long extended jam music. But as it was, it wound up falling a little bit short of my top 20. Meanwhile, Pentangle released their third album in 1969. Pentangle, like Fairpoint Convention, was a folk-based band featuring a female lead singer, in this case, Jackie McShay. Pentangle's third album was Basket of Light, and this album would be the band's peak commercial success, and its most influential album as well. On Basket of Light, Pentangle combined English folk music with jazz fusion influences. I guess you might call this progressive folk, or folk fusion. It's a pretty unique sound for 1969. It's very enjoyable, though I personally tend to prefer Fairpoint Convention's more whimsical and loose-sounding music style. But let's go ahead and listen to some Pentangle now. Enjoy!
Once I had a sweetheart and now I have none. Once I had a sweetheart and now I have none. He's gone and left me, he's gone.
So, while bands like Pentangle and Fairpoint Convention were pretty popular at the time and influential in their development of what I'm calling progressive folk, the main musical movement in England at the time was really in the progressive rock scene. There will be one English prog rock band that makes my 1969 top 20 list, but most of the stuff out of that scene in 1969 really sounds kind of bad to my ears. Some notable examples among the more established bands that were somewhat aligned with the emerging prog rock movement included Pink Floyd releasing two new albums in 1969. One of these albums was a bit of a meandering soundtrack to the film More. The other new Floyd album was the double album Umma Gumma. The first LP of Umma Gumma consisted of live recordings of versions of the band's songs off of their first two albums. And those live recordings are all pretty outstanding. They featured early Pink Floyd at their most haunting level of extended madness. Meanwhile, the second LP was filled with new studio recordings by the band, and that second LP is all pretty weak stuff in my opinion. The band was experimenting to try and find new directions for their sound, but those new directions hadn't really gelled yet. Meanwhile, the Moody Blues also released two new albums in 1969. Both of these albums sound almost comically pretentious to my modern ears. They really are an example of the type of music that makes it easy to mock the hippie movement of the era.
Take another sip, my love, and see what you will see. A fleet of golden galleons on a crystal sea. Are you sitting comfortably at Merlin Castle's bed?
Another English band, The Nice, released their third album in 1969, with half of that album being live and half of that album being new studio recordings. The Nice, at this time, was recording fairly listenable jazz rock fusion type of music, although their songs also featured what I think is pretty weak songwriting. So, most of the songs on this album aren't that good, other than the songs where the band is covering Tim Hardin and Bob Dylan. Also in 1969, Soft Machine released their second album. I like the first album by Soft Machine, and I absolutely love their third album. But the Soft Machine's second album is almost unlistenable to me. It's like the band was unable to hold on to an idea long enough for it to form into anything particularly worthwhile before they would move on to the next idea that popped into their heads. They simply didn't seem to have enough focus at this period. There were also some new debut albums in the prog realm in 1969. Genesis released their debut in 1969. And though Genesis would become one of the biggest prog rock bands and then would later transform themselves into a successful pop band. In 1969, on their debut album, Genesis was actually a pretty derivative psychedelic band at the time.
The motion of a turning wheel. Can't you stop it and look around?
Baby, you feel so close.
Their debut album, to me, really is pretty horrible stuff. Another debut was by the band Coliseum, who released their first two albums in 1969. Coliseum had a much more American-sounding style of jazz and blues rock fusion. Their albums were among the better prog rock releases for 1969 to my ears. Not extraordinary, but solid stuff. One of the key prog rock bands of all time would be Yes, and Yes also made their debut in 1969. The seeds of what Yes would turn into can certainly be heard on this debut album in bits and pieces.
Trees of silver foam cast shadows soft in winter home. Swaying branches breaking sound. Lonely forest trembling ground.
But the band were definitely pursuing a bit more straightforward style of rock on this debut album than the more complicated epic type of songs that they soon would become known for. So none of these albums wound up making my top 20 list. Beyond the classical and jazz fusion influences bubbling up in the prog rock scene, there were also new bands pursuing experimental approaches influenced by avant-garde composers, using experimental, emerging electronic music technologies. In England, this direction was represented with the 1969 debut album by the pioneering electronic music band called White Noise, who released their album An Electronic Storm. This album used the first marketed English synthesizer, as well as utilizing tap modulation and tape loops. The album is a very odd mix of pop songcraft with warbling, strange, and slightly spooky electronic sound effects and vocal chirps.
Beyond the outside world's one left to right. Within ourselves the sun saw the night. Just bound by blue with the reality. Drifting out to my dream free.
It's no surprise at all that this album sold poorly at the time. I'm quite sure that even the most drug-infused listeners of the time found this album simply too weird to mentally deal with at the time. But An Electronic Storm wound up developing a cult following over the years, and in these days, it's often hailed by the electronic music scene as a major early influence. The creative center of the new electronic music scene in the 1970s would wind up coalescing in Germany. In 1969, the first of these German bands that would be associated with what is now known as krautrock released their debut album. This band was called Can, and they released their first album in 1969, titled Monster Movie. Although, at the time, the band was called The Can. They would later remove the from their name and simply be called Can. Monster Movie's electronic keyboards weren't as weirdly warped as the White Noise album. Instead, on this album, the keyboards provide more of a running wall of anxious dissonance to the band's free jazz-influenced rock fusion music, which at this point also had some fairly obvious Velvet Underground influences to it. Can's music was heavily improvisational, and Side B of Monster Movie contains a studio-edited 20 minutes that were taken from over 6 albums of studio jam sessions by the band. I personally absolutely adore Can, and this debut album by the band is satisfyingly adventurous, but it doesn't really match up with the best of the band's later work. And Monster Movie was never actually released officially in the United States. It was only available as an import until 1990, when it was finally released as a series of reissues for the CD buying public. So that also gave me an important reason to leave it off of my top 20 list for the year, since, as I've noted a number of times, I like to try and base my lists around American release dates. But this album didn't have an American release date until 1990. But let's listen to a little bit of Can now. Enjoy!
Look down at the place of mind behind the curtain of sleep that is found emerging that is true. And with you, mother screams, I am mother. Woman screams, I am fertile. And the father can't yell.
It wasn't only England that had a lot of experimentalism going on. Musicians in the United States in 1969 were busy pursuing their own experimental directions. On the electronic music front, the band Silver Apples were a New York-based psychedelic rock band that was using a homemade synthesizer. Silver Apples released their second album in 1969, titled Contact. The album is really pretty wild stuff for the era. Like White Noise in England, Silver Apples had a knack for pop soundcraft, but they liked to bury it under a wall of odd electronic sounds. More impressive than the music was the inventiveness of the band's self-made synthesizers. Let's listen to a little bit of Silver Apples.
You and I could walk together. You and I could talk together. You and I could have each other. You and I could touch each other. But we don't have time for little things. No, there just ain't room for little things. Why?
Cro-Magnon released their only album, Orgasm, in 1969. Orgasm relied mostly on acoustic sounds. But still, Cro-Magnon delivered a very weird sound mix of primitive drums, with band members banging sticks and rocks together for percussion, along with grunts, sound effects, and even some bagpipes in the mix. The results were a very lo-fi precursor to the sounds that would become industrial rock in later decades. Orgasm was definitely among the stranger releases in what I have already noted is a strange year. Beyond anything else I will mention in this 1969 project, however, nothing in America was more odd than the first major label release featuring the 68-year-old Harry Partch. Harry Partch was a music theorist, an experimental composer, and an instrument inventor. Partch created his own instruments in order to pursue compositions based around microtonal scales that were not traditionally used in Western music. Partch actually burned his earlier work in the late 1930s as a symbolic breakup with Western music traditions. Harry Partch had self-recorded and released music for many years, but in 1969, Columbia Records released a compilation album of his works from over the years, mostly taken from his compositions of the 1940s, but also featuring a lead-off track of his most recent composition from 1967. Let's listen to a little bit of that now. Probably the most famous experimental music weirdness of the year was produced by Captain Beefheart with his much-debated album, Trout Mask Replica. This album combines a unique fusion of free jazz, outsider blues, surrealism, and spoken word silliness to create a double album that zigzags in styles, themes, precision, and focus. Generations of adventurous music fans have puzzled over this album since its release, with some of those hailing the album as a work of genius, and others thinking it a bunch of pretentious garbage. I sort of wind up in the middle of those two extremes. I philosophically like the contrary spirit of Captain Beefheart, and I adore a lot of outsider music that has been influenced by Captain Beefheart's work, such as the Minutemen, or Tom Waits, those being just two such examples with wildly different musical styles that have both equally been influenced by Beefheart. The problem is that, at this point, Trout Mask Replica has gathered simply too much hype, in my opinion. If you listen to the album with the expectation of it being one of the greatest albums of its era or all time, you will wind up wading through it wondering when it's going to suddenly start to sound brilliant rather than simply eccentric. I personally think that Beefheart's music sounds better in live performance than it does under the stiffer, get-the-perfect-take confines of the studio. Although in the case of Beefheart, what he considers a perfect take is much more loosely defined than it is with most studio experts. It's hard to choose just one song off of a sprawling work like this to stand as its musical example, but I'll try here anyway.
Let their nectar come into the air around her. She love, her love sticks out like stars. Her loving stick out like stars.
Heading off to a different continent, 1969 brought out the second album from the eclectic Brazilian psychedelic band Os Mutantes. This band have slowly built a cult following of devotees over the years. Os Mutantes' debut album had come out in 1968, and it fused American folk rock, English invasion-style rock, psychedelia, and traditional Brazilian music, adding in electronic noise and sound samples. This 1969 follow-up album continues in that same vein, though with stronger musical precision and extra emphasis on the sound sampling from movies and TV. Like their first album, the second Os Mutantes album hops around in style, not only between songs, but often in movements within the same songs. Os Mutantes is a truly unique and bizarre band. I wish I understood more of their lyrics, though I have a feeling that it might not make the songs make any more sense based on the eclecticism of their music. Let's listen to a little bit now.
Baiano estrangeiro, meu sangue é de gasolina, correndo não tenho mágoa, meu peito é de sal de fruta, bebendo no copo d'água.
Continuing to hop around the world, let's move to the Caribbean island of Jamaica. Jamaica had been going through a rich period of musical invention during the 1960s, as ska had morphed into rock steady, and by the late 1960s was emerging into a new genre called reggae. In Jamaica, the music scene was largely focused in the 1960s on making singles, with jukeboxes and DJ culture being predominant on the island. So the focus had definitely not been on making great albums. The albums of Jamaican artists at the time were generally aimed at the English marketplace, where this music was widely available due to the heavy presence of Caribbean immigrants to that country, and due to Jamaica's history as an English colony, with Jamaica having just gained its full independence in 1962. So, what albums there were during this era from Jamaica were not generally being released in America. Under my typical rules that focuses on American release dates, this makes most Jamaican music albums of the time ineligible for my top 20 list. The Wailers were already very active in Jamaica at this time, releasing singles, but the band was still a year out from the release of their Soul Rebels album, and even that album wouldn't be officially released in America until the 1980s. The major production collaborator for the Wailers in the late 1960s was Lee Scratch Perry. Perry released two albums himself under his band name The Upsetters. Neither of these albums were released in America until well into the 2000s. Jimmy Cliff released his debut album in 1969, and this album would be released in America, although it didn't actually come out here until 1970. So once again, we have an album here that is ineligible under my self-imposed rules. Cliff's debut album would be retitled from the simple Jimmy Cliff title that was used in Jamaica and England, and instead would be given the title Wonderful World, Beautiful People, the song of that name having been released as a single and had become a hit in America. An actual 1969 American release came from Desmond Dekker's album, The Israelites. So I was at least able to give that album some consideration. The song, The Israelites, was released in 1968, and that song served as the title song for the Desmond Dekker album, and the lead-off track for the album. The Israelites is fantastic, and the rest of the album is enjoyable. But none of the rest of the album hits at that same level of genius as the Israelites did. So, ultimately, while I was able to consider Desmond Dekker for 1969, his album did not actually make my final cut. Perhaps the most important reggae album of 1969 came from Toots and the Maytals. The Maytals had been a very popular ska band in the early part of the 1960s, and the band had continued that success as music evolved there into rock steady. The Maytals had actually been the originators of the name for reggae music when they released the song Do the Reggae. The third album of the Maytals' career, Sweet and Dandy, was released in Jamaica and in France in 1969. This album contained a compilation of the Maytals' landmark 1960s hits, such as Monkey Man, Sweet and Dandy, 5446, That's My Number, and the absolute stone-cold classic song, Pressure Drop. Oh, yeah! However, the Sweet and Dandy album was never released in America. In America, the absolute brilliance of the Maytals would not become apparent until they were featured on the 1972 soundtrack of the movie The Harder They Come. That soundtrack included recordings of Pressure Drop and Sweet and Dandy. The movie and the soundtrack would wind up making Jimmy Cliff a worldwide star in the early 1970s. But that soundtrack album also helped to bring Toots and the Maytals to a much larger audience that they well deserved. Despite my emphasis on all the weird music of 1969, of course, the year wasn't just all weirdness and experimentation. It was also an era in which the standard filler material for classic rock radio was rolling out in a continuous stream, like cans from a food factory. The term jazz rock was a big trend for 1969. There were a number of new bands being lumped under this label, all of whom had adopted a horn-infused rock music style. Chicago released their debut album in 1989 under their original name, Chicago Transit Authority.
A man came up to me and asked me,
I've never particularly cared for the term jazz rock. because the jazz music that I personally enjoy has so much more adventure, freedom, and emotion to it than these sort of radio-friendly horn bands tend to provide. These bands do tend to call to mind the more easy-listening big band era of jazz, I guess. So, I guess I can't completely discount the term. I just don't think these bands are interesting enough for it really to fit under my definition of jazz. The music industry had caught up to the new harder rock style, and it was quickly cashing in on it. There's a reason why a lot of those old bands only have a handful of songs that get routinely played. Most of the rest of the deep cuts on their albums, beyond their small number of hits, tended to be fairly generic, formulaic, and forgettable, and sometimes just plain bad. Grand Funk Railroad released their debut album in 1969.
I said, hey there, baby, do you want to make the scene? Oh, well, come on over, baby, step into my time machine. You better jump into my action. I'm gonna make you feel right.
The James Band also debuted in 1969. The Guess Who were several albums into their career, but they were just beginning to really get noticed outside of Canada.
And I will never be free, no, no, no. You took the vow with me, yeah. You spoke it, you spoke it, hey. These eyes are crying. Seen a lot of love, but they're never gonna see another one like I have.
Vanilla Fudge were on the downside of what had really been a little bit of an unimpressive career run.
The beach was so deserted. There was no life to find. It looked like the beginning. It looked like end of time.
Alice Cooper's debut album, Pretty's for You, came out in 1969. This was one of the worst albums that I listened to for this entire 1969 listening project. At the start of his career, Cooper was attempting to hop onto the psychedelic rock bandwagon, and it didn't really suit him or his band very well. Cooper would have much greater success with his later glammed-up shock rock music. But I still don't personally think Alice Cooper was ever really all that great. In my opinion, he was a little bit of a hack as a musician, who wound up finally finding a marketable gimmick that he has stood on for the remainder of his career. If he was the type of artist that had a slew of great ideas, he might have continued to reinvent himself, like great artists like David Bowie have done. But Alice Cooper finally found his one gimmick, and he has rode it ever since. Over in England, the band Free made their debut album in 1969, and this was definitely one of the best sounding of the new commercially focused hard rock bands of the time. Free's lead singer, Paul Rodgers, would pretty much become the definitive rock voice, in my opinion. And Free had a solid blues rock foundation to their music. But still, there were not enough truly great songs on Free's first two albums for either of them to be true contenders for my list of favorites from the year.
Generously, so generously.
the Jeff Beck Group had the advantage of their extremely gifted lead guitar player, who gave the band their name, and the band had imported Rod Stewart as their new lead singer for their 1968 debut album and for the 1969 second album from the group. And yet, the Jeff Beck Group couldn't score a hit because their albums just didn't have very strong songs on them, aside from their covers of pre-existing rock hits. Jeff Beck, for all of his musical gifts, simply never became an accomplished songwriter, and he didn't seem to see the necessity of consistently pairing up with one. Rod Stewart would also wind up releasing his debut solo album in 1969. And this album, in my opinion, was a very meandering and unfocused mix of stylistic influences. Deep Purple was floundering a bit in 1969, after having had a strong career start, and the band would certainly have revolutionary albums to come later. Deep Purple's third studio album came out in 1969, and it was pretty weak, and they also released an ill-advised live album, with Deep Purple paired with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. It didn't really work for their sound at all. The English band Humble Pie made a mediocre debut album in 1969.
Well, first how's the feel like they're walking when you're red, and it ain't too hard to see that you're worth more to the dead. Don't you know the time man runs until the nearest band? God, you
Meanwhile, the band Spirit was on their third album, and that band was already hitting declining returns on their albums by this third time.
Dark-eyed woman on a hot summer night. Dark-eyed woman, are you burning tonight? Dark-eyed woman, won't you step in the light and tell me, dark-eyed woman, are you burning tonight? Tonight. Well, dark-eyed woman, it's a quarter to four. I hear your voice like a child at my door. Dark-eyed woman, I could love you once more.
There were quite a number of bands in similar molds that never even had the big radio hit breakouts that bands such as these that I've just mentioned wound up having. 1969 wound up being a great year for traditional blues releases. There will be one excellent pure blues album that shows up in my top 20. And there will also be a debut album by a truly excellent blues-based rock band in that top 20. But beyond those choices, which will be revealed later, there were also two new albums by the legendary Muddy Waters. The first of these two albums attempted crossover success by relying heavily on a psychedelic rock sound.
Well, I'm rolling out.
A route that Muddy Waters had also taken on his 1968 album, Electric Mud. The second of Muddy Waters for the year was a double album that had an all-star band backing him up. And on this album, Muddy Waters pursued a sound much truer to his late 1950s style. That album was called Fathers and Sons. Fathers and Sons contains one studio LP as well as one live LP. And it's a very good album. And the album would point the way to the type of excellent albums Muddy would later make in the mid-70s with Johnny Winter as his producer.
I lose my baby boy, it ain't that bad. Had a sweet little girl. I lose my baby boy, it ain't that bad. Well, you know you can't spend what you ain't got. You can't lose some little girl you ain't never had.
Another traditional blues legend with a new album out in 1969 was Mississippi Fred McDowell. McDowell had become nationally known due to the field recording work of Alan Lomax in 1959. These recordings displayed a unique approach to the blues, which had become known as the North Hills Country Blues, based on the Mississippi region that McDowell was from. McDowell was mostly famous for his acoustic slide guitar style, but he could play electric guitar as well. On his 1969 album would wind up being his first studio recording with an electric style on display. But just in case anybody thought this might be a nod to the popular culture of the time, the album title put the issue to rest when the album was called I Do Not Play No Rock and Roll. It's a very good album, and I actually gave a lot of consideration to it for my top 20.
You may be low, you may be rich, you may be, but one day low is red. You got to move.
A great new blues musician on the rise in 1969 was Taj Mahal, who released his debut album and his second album in 1968, and he followed that up in 1969 with a double album. The double album had a double title as well, with the first disc of this double album being titled Giant Step, which was an electric LP, and Dem Old Folks at Home, which was an acoustic LP, with the two LPs being distributed as a single double album. While Taj Mahal was a dedicated admirer of classic blues musicians, and he could mimic the styles of many of them, Taj had also studied musicology at the University of Massachusetts. So he was a musician who brought in influences of many world cultures to his blues music style. I personally love Taj Mahal, and I've seen him quite a number of times in concert over the years. This early album from him is very good, but it doesn't yet display the fully grown musical vision that Taj Mahal would build over time, though there are some early hints of those styles. This double album contains my favorite Taj Mahal recording, however, which was a cover of a song written by Carole King and Gary Goffin that had been originally recorded by the Monkees. Taj's version of it completely transforms the song, and his arrangement sounds completely unique to any other blues or pop music being played at the time. It was the first signs of the originality that I so love about Taj Mahal's career. And this song is one of my favorite songs of the year. It's a song that would certainly make my list of top 20 songs, even though the album that it came off of fell a little bit short of that mark. Let's listen to this song now. This song is Take a Giant Step. Enjoy.
This time you felt like that again. There is just no percentage in remembering the past. It's time you learn to live again and love at last. Come with me, leave your yesterday behind. And take a giant step outside your mind.
A number of the bands that I've discussed so far for 1969 would wind up being major influences to the future underground music scenes of the 70s and 80s, including influences on glam, punk rock, new wave, and alternative music of the future. But no band of this era really had bigger long-term impact than the Velvet Underground. 1969 would bring out the Velvet Underground's third album, which was a self-titled album. This album would provide a major change in the direction for the band, as it moved away from the experimental noise rock of their second album, and instead produced an album consisting of ballads, as well as a couple of pretty straightforward rock songs. In many ways, I think this is the most important Velvet Underground album due to the approach and style of the band in tackling this kind of more mellow material. In an era that was becoming known for its heavy use of string arrangements and precise, pretty vocals for most ballads, the Velvet Underground took these sorts of songs and broke them down to very minimalist arrangements, with Lou Reed singing them in his normal, unassuming, everyman talking singing style. It's this kind of work that convinced so many new generations of musicians that you didn't need to be a virtuoso player or an operatic style singer in order to make great music. You just needed to have something to say. I like the Velvet Underground album quite a bit, and the simple joys of a song like Pale Blue Eyes makes it one of my favorite Velvet Underground songs. But after bouncing in and out of the top 20 as I tried to finalize my list, this album wound up being amongst the final cuts. It certainly should get an honorable mention spot for the year. While I like the music quite a bit on this album, I think it's obvious that my main musical loyalty tends to lie with what these days is called jam band music. 1969 was a huge year for the foundations on which a lot of modern jam bands have built their sound. Not all of the bands that made my top 20 list were big on extended jams or musical improvisation, but the majority of them that I'll be revealing in my top 20 were in this style, and the few ones that do not fall into that style were still major influences on the jam band scene due to their contributions to lyrical and compositional ideas that wound up becoming important for that music scene. So, the Velvet Underground ultimately drew the short straw and wound up outside the top 20 for my final list. It should be noted that the Velvet Underground were actually known for their live improvisational jams as well, but this album from the band is much more in line with my love of 80s college rock than it is for my love of jam, and so this album wound up falling a bit short for me. Let's listen to Pale Blue Eyes now. This song will end this episode. Please join me again next episode when I will begin revealing my top 20 favorite albums of 1969. As always, if you want to send me any comments, criticisms, or questions, you can email tony@roadtojamnation.com. Or if you're on Facebook, you can join my Road to Jam Nation Facebook group. Or you can also find me on X, what used to be called Twitter, under my actual name of Tony Kurilic. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll be back. Now here's Velvet Underground with Pale Blue Eyes. Enjoy!
Sometimes I feel so happy, but mostly you just make me mad. Baby, you just make me mad. Linger on.